I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to Dynasty As They Want to Be, a podcast where we drill into every episode of the iconic 1980s television series, Dynasty. I'm your host, Derek J. Lang, and with me is my co-host, Kyler K. Jafari.
Flames, flames, from the side of my face, heaving.
Keep going.
You're just supposed to look at me like I'm an insane bitch.
I do that all the time.
Okay, well, I'm just giving you more fodder.
You know, they keep saying they're going to remake Clue, or they're going to do like a reboot.
They
of
better
Clue.
Not.
And I think like Ryan Reynolds.
I will
is
really have flames from the side of my face if they do that.
I just don't understand like who needs that. Like
nobody asked for that. That's like, okay, we could remake a lot of things that didn't need to be remade. But we all universally acknowledge the original is the only thing you need. There's no, nothing's ever going to be Madeline Kahn or Eileen Brennan or Tim Curry or
so
Christopher Lloyd.
It's so culty that there's like probably not a lot of people that are like, oh yeah, I need to see a new version of it because they didn't even see the fucking original.
And also the board games for like sort of basic bitches don't really have anything else better to do with their time.
A lot of people don't even know how to play the board game, I think.
It's just like the, you know, deductive reasoning stuff, but it's kind of robotic. It's actually not very strategic. The mechanic of the game is not, you know, particularly intellectual.
Yeah, but we're obviously big Clue heads because, you know, we once had that Clue dinner party where we reenacted. We invited the exact number of characters and everybody had to dress up, and I went all out on the invitations, but they look like little pieces, and I went
and
on
this
eBay.
This wasn't no flapper party from Dynasty stuff. I think everybody was like seriously tuned into the costumes.
Oh, well, everybody that got invited to that Clue dinner party, I think, is like still our bestest friends ever because they were just so enamored with getting a exclusive invitation.
Right. I think Clue is like the cement that has bonded all of our friendships.
Yeah, maybe that's like how we know if we like people or not. We're like, oh, do you like the 1988 movie Clue?
Who's she?
Oh, bye. I'm gotta go wash my hair.
Yeah, it's pretty sad, but I don't know. We find ways to make friends, I guess. That's what humans do. So
I love like 80s comedies, and it just makes me so sad that we don't really make movies like that anymore. Like those late 80s, early 90s comedies,
well,
like
know,
Mannequin.
A different world.
You know, with like animated opening credits.
Well, I mean, this is kind of like how that weird Memphis design philosophy has come back, which I identified 2 or 3 years ago because I was trying to buy funky Japanese dinnerware from the 80s, which basically just means it's got like cutouts and it all comes in weird watermelon colors and like
Catherine O'Hara was using it to eat on the side of Beetlejuice.
Yeah, it's like there's so much whimsy from this movement, and it totally translates in these like 80s movie intro title card, whatever extravaganzas.
Yeah, the Sally Cruikshank.
I think we
animation.
All have Sally Cruikshank to thank. I mean, I don't know. I think there was some Japanese design that kind of like underpinned it too, that came from the late 70s, which also, I mean, Sally Cruikshank was doing it from then too. But anyway.
Well, you kind of are starting to get a little bit of that in Dynasty with like the weird color choices and stuff. Now that Jeff's office is all finished, I'm starting to see like how that 80s palette, how we get to that point where
I kind of disagree because like what the Sally Cruikshank slash Memphis design, whatever that stuff was all about primary colors and like whimsy. And this, even if it's like sort of a brighter shade of blue, it's still very adult and sophisticated and understated.
There's like giant like metal sculptures, okay, so like let's in the just middle talk of about, the office.
Let's just talk about it. Okay, so the intro credits to Ruthless People is probably the highest example of what we're talking about. It's like basically like yellow and hot pink. And
well,
the animation is always like an alligator coming out of a suitcase and like a stretched ginger jar lamp. Why were lamps like such a thing in like these
well,
animated
then there's
intros?
A lot of like clock faces too.
Yeah,
you
that
notice
too.
That like people have like arrow
so it's
for
all
noses.
Extreme cartoon, and like I'm not getting that from.
I'm not
Jeff's
saying that they're
office.
Doing that in Dynasty. I'm just saying even here in the early 80s, I can see us moving in that direction. Where there's a weird color palette, like whatever happening in Jeff's office, where there's like a crazy silhouette of a metal sculpture against this like bright teal color. I mean, that's nobody was doing stuff like that.
No, that's not true. That's the typical birds in flight sculpture that's been going on since the late 60s.
There's other sculptures in there besides those 60s bird sculptures too.
There's the other one that's like a 50s
marble-y kind
it's
of
not
one.
Picasso. I forget the sculptor who did those, but that's from like before. So
okay,
that's
but
just
they
modern
weren't
art
putting
sculpture
they weren't putting
about.
Modern art against a crazy shade of blue.
I don't think
that has lead
that
in
crazy.
It.
What's crazy about it is what's in it.
Anyway, I can see how we're sort of going in that direction. But yeah, it's funny how like that was an accepted thing where like the opening credits of a movie were like child animation.
And in some ways were probably better than the rest of the movie. So like the other one is like Loverboy.
Mannequin.
That's right. With all the Egyptian stuff, which was also relevant
like
in the Memphis design movement.
Well, that's true. But that's almost, that one's like a prologue because it's telling you all about Kim Cattrall's life before she landed in Philadelphia.
Well, if you watch any of these animated intros though, they were sort of, you know, giving you the story ahead of time, like Greek chorus style, you know?
Sort of. I mean, I think the mannequin one was more literal. The other ones were, like the Loverboy one was like cars humping each other or something. I don't know.
Yeah, but with a pizza with alligator teeth or something.
Oh, yeah, because that's what Patrick Dempsey serves in the movie, alligator pizza.
Right. If you want hot sex with Patrick Dempsey, order anchovies on your pizza. There's something like so escapist and comforting about these moments in 80s filmmaking because it almost feels like summer, and it is summer now. Well, where we are, it's basically summer. They're just sort of like bright, warm, carefree, you know, like something about this whole aesthetic was just, you know, not
giving any fucks.
Yeah, and I get it because in the 80s, well, at least the mid to late 80s, everybody had like all this money and everybody was so optimistic. So these things like were just sort of like fluffy and exciting. And
well, I can see why people are into it now because we've mined everything. Like mid-century modern has come back a bunch of times. Coastal and Baroque things. Nobody brought back the
80s design was like
80s.
Something like we used to make fun of. And like anybody with taste up until about 10 years ago would have even made fun of. But it's sort of the last thing that took a stand, even if it was just sort of comical and maybe even nihilistic in some ways. Like it was sort of anti-design.
Well, and something about younger generations have latched onto it too. Cause like the other day on one of the Drag Race episodes, a younger contestant did like a whole Bert and Ernie Juggalo Memphis, like PB Playhouse kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's like, how did you learn about this?
Oh yeah. That's like PB's Playhouse might have been Memphis design philosophy in live action. Well, I mean, obviously it was recorded, but live action.
To me, that was like ground zero was PB's Playhouse.
again, it was just sort of like nihilistic or at least chaotic.
Yeah, I don't think they had any idea when they were making Peavey's Playhouse what an impression they were making on the young generation and even younger generations.
This is what great artists do. They just do what they do, and hopefully the masses receive it, even if it takes a century.
Well, what I'm receiving this week is Acapulco, where we have our own kind of interesting design. We kind of mentioned Jeff's office, but then there's like a great visit to a suite in Acapulco by Crystal, and I don't know. We're on a roll here. Anyway, I'm ready to get into this week's episode. Are you ready to get into it?
Well, I will say I think the writers got a little bored with Denver, and so we've been getting some international
flair. Well, let's get into
the
episode, and then we can get into that. Today's installment of Dynasty as They Want to Be is brought to you by Audible. Audible is offering Our Darlings a free audiobook with a 30-day trial membership. Just go to audibletrial.com/nastypodcast. That's NASTY podcast, and browse their unrivaled selection of audio programs. If you need a totally campy escape, and who doesn't right now, they have like over 20 of Jackie Collins's books on there, including my fave, Poor Little Bitch Girl. I'm sure you'll find something you love too. Simply go to audibletrial.com/nastypodcast to get started today. Welcome back. Oh my God. So this episode is called Acapulco, which we've heard mentioned several times.
Well, this is Alexis's old stomping ground.
Yeah, right? I guess she lived there.
I'm imagining her like in a sombrero and some sort of caftan thing and drinking margaritas.
And earlier in this season, she had a little off-screen jaunt to Acapulco because she picked up that pinata donkey for Little Blake.
That's right. So I don't know. Was America having a thing with Acapulco back then? Like, this was the place to be.
It reminds me of growing up in Florida in the 80s, the Epcot Mexican ride. There was a lot of Acapulco in that. So I think I didn't personally get to go to Acapulco in the 80s, but I think it was a pretty popular tourist destination. Do you want to talk about what we're drinking in honor of this episode, Acapulco?
Yeah, well, sure. Crystal and Blake even have one of these. Like, it's a margarita, but
spicy.
We've subbed out the tequila for melon vibe. Vodka. This is like one of those
that's
things.
That's embarrassing. Please not talk about
it's,
that.
It's like one of those things, like, how did this even make its way into the liquor cabinet? I don't know. Maybe because somebody knew somebody who gambled their life savings away at a casino and they got this shitty bottle of melon vodka in return. So we inherited this as a Christmas present or something. I don't know. Anyway, so it's like, what do you do when life gives you melon vodka? Make
melon vodka margaritas? Well, you've done like a chili salt rim one here. Oh, there's no salt. Is it just chili?
It's chili salt. I did my best to like make this more than just a trailer park drink.
Yeah, it gives it a nice little kick when you put it to your lips. But
so I guess the trick with any of these flavored vodkas is they sugar them up a tad and they dial down the alcohol content.
Of course.
So you don't use as much of the other sweet ingredients, which there's only another one, just triple sec. So you dial down the triple sec, and then you just put it in a blender with a shit ton of ice and hope it comes out. You just pray.
Yeah.
But well, I do think the chili rim offsets the drink color-wise, too. So you have, like, your green and red. You know, complimentary colors, y'all.
Yeah.
Although, I don't know what's so complimentary about green and red, because I feel like not even on Christmas are those colors that belong next to each other, but
bah humbug in May. Anyway, besides Acapulco, there's also a trip to Washington, D.C. I mean, there's a lot of like globetrotting going on.
We got some Paris name dropping. Yeah, you got it all.
Yeah, they're really expanding the scope of this
so
world.
So international.
We kind of pick up where we left off last week with Congressman Neil McVeigh. Alexis's boudoir charms did not work. So the good congressman is going to D.C. with Blake. And it's so funny. He just gets totally bought off. He gets a free ride in the PJ and all you can drink Bloody Marys.
I have to think that there's like some weird homosexual subtext that I'm making it up. Like, it's clearly not
in this margarita.
What's the word I'm looking
for? Implied.
It's not intended, but it's just sort of like, oh, well, Blake's trying to like play off what Alexis was doing at the party in the prior episode. So Blake's gonna like take the, you know, congressman up in his plane, ply him with liquor. Maybe he can work that angle. Obviously, that's not really what's happening. But
yeah, well, whatever he did works because the loan goes through and Denver Carrington is saved again. I swear to God, this is only the third season. I feel like Denver Carrington has been on the brink of collapse 92 times.
This is an example of a sort of small-ish company that is capable of generating large profits, but the swings mean that when it's on a low cycle, you know, things can get dire.
Mm-hmm.
So I understand that. But I like this idea of, like, you know, we can drink and have gay sex in the plane because whatever happens up
where
in the air.
Are you kidding? This gay sex thing? Neither.
I think Blake's jealous that Alexis like used her hoochie coochie to like, although it didn't really work out for her. So maybe not. But I just like this idea that like, you know, you can drink in the plane because whatever happens up in the air doesn't really happen. So it's like, well, maybe he's working the congressman too.
Well, yeah. The timing doesn't work out because if they're leaving Denver and then they're going to go to Washington and Blake tells Congressman McVane to not drink because they got a lot to do. It's like, wait a minute. By the time they land, like most of the day is going to be over. Am I the only one who understands how time zones work? But whatever. It's fun to see the PJ. And did you notice they installed a television? I thought maybe we were going to be watching some video cassette of the blackmail, the sexy blackmail that Blake has on Congressman McVane, but they didn't actually show that.
No, so, Blake's just boo-hoo. All talk. That's all Blake does. He just talks. Like, you know, if he wants something done, he screams at somebody on the phone, like, but he never really does anything.
Well, I was actually pretty surprised at his reaction in dealing with Crystal this episode. And oh my God, Crystal's got a lot going on. As soon as she sees Blake off, she's like packing her bags and calling Mark Jennings and having one of her little infamous meetings in the forest. I don't think she's had one of these meetings in the forest with one of her suitors since Matthew Blaisdell. I don't know. Well, she sort of met with Dr. Parpadelli in the forest at one point, or maybe just
It's always like, I don't know, but see, this is what Crystal does. Like, she can never deal with her issues out on Front Street. She never like can take a direct attack.
Well, she's a kept woman.
It's always like, you know, on the down low. She's just all undercover, but like it mostly backfires on her because she's so powerless and she can just never execute her own strategy.
But I do think that this episode, she is so much more powerful than we've seen her. I wanted to stand up and give a round of applause when she books this trip to Mexico to go deal with the divorce papers. Joseph, the malicious majordomo, is like, well, where are you going? Well, what am I supposed to tell Mr. Carrington? And she's like, well, if you don't know anything, you can't say anything. Bye, bitch.
What shall I tell Mr. Carrington when he calls from Washington? I mean, this sudden trip.
Say that I have important personal business.
In Mexico?
Yes.
Well, where exactly? It's a very large country.
I'll be in touch.
Well, I have to tell Mr. Carrington something.
Joseph, if you don't know anything, there's nothing to tell.
I've never seen her so
committed. Yeah, that was kind of a mic drop moment. And the thing is that might be the one time she ever won an argument with Joseph.
Yeah, she
because
shut
otherwise,
him up.
Like, I don't know that she's so much powerful in this episode at all. But that's the one moment.
Well, no,
where
yeah. Once
she
gets
through
to Mexico, she starts acting like a complete nincompoop. Like, I don't understand why this isn't dealt with. Blake actually later in the episode deals with it very quickly. He's like, the state of Colorado is going to issue you a divorce. It's going to be very cut and dry. But meanwhile, she spent God knows how much money and fuel on getting to Acapulco.
Yeah,
just
she's
to
like
find
frittering
out
her away Blake's Amex card to go to Acapulco and see a lawyer about a horse. And
which I can't, you know, I can't complain about.
Big shocker. The court system in Mexico, judge forged documents. Like, who knew?
Well,
like,
Mark Jennings told her in the woods that he got this divorce drunk at a bar, but she still felt the need to go check it out for herself. It's like, whatever.
I love that Crystal's basically just a bit of horse trading at a bar for Mark. I mean, that's kind of what it boils down to with this.
Yeah,
this
there's
marriage,
not really
not
much
marriage
to the end of their relationship. He was a drunk and he went off and left her, and they wanted to have kids and he stole money from her. It's not really that interesting, TBH.
No, it's really not. I mean, it's kind of what you've already been seeing, and all this just kind of confirms what you already knew. But there it is anyway. And you have Crystal in Acapulco at like a, I don't know what that is, like a Motel 6 or what is that?
I don't know. It seemed like a resort from the interior shots, but the exterior, it's like she was at the Sheraton.
Yeah, Sheraton. That's a solid Sheraton. For sure.
It seems to me that she is probably more invested in Mark than she's letting on, because she keeps flashing back. She's flashed back to losing her V-card.
No more of these
like
fish tank views.
And then this episode, she flashed back to last week, which I get it. You know, in the 80s, I don't think they had the previously on Dynasty, so you don't know right at the top what happened, but she's always thinking about Mark Jennings.
Well, back then your soap opera IQ was higher too, because you actually tuned in every episode.
You were only watching three shows.
Yeah,
a
you
week.
Didn't. Yeah, you had time, so you did not miss an episode. So you didn't need all of that. But also, what does that imply about the show if you need to recap stuff? Because it's like, oh, well, we know you didn't watch it last time, so here it is.
Yeah, even the writers were thinking you're probably getting bored with this Mark Jennings stuff, so we have to keep refreshing your memory. But it all falls apart in the end because even. Oh, so yeah, going back to what I was saying, I kind of liked Blake's reaction to the whole thing. He was very methodical. He wasn't judging her. He kind of won me over a little bit in his reaction to
finding out
that his wife isn't really married to him.
For a minute, but then like they, you know, they go back to their bedroom in, you know, Denver and have another argument. Here we go again with Crystal, who can't manage her affairs.
It's not an argument. It's her being a dumb bitch.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's very much like Blake as, you know, the intellectually driven thoughts and facts, and she's just all feelings and fifis, and just everything's murky with her. And like, oh, but Mark, I was married to him once and I owe him an apology.
It's like, I'm with Blake. No, you don't. Like this
lady
is very
quit it.
Cut and dry.
Yeah, but you know, at this point, like, I've given up on Crystal, so none of this surprises me. But I'm sure the audience, if they hadn't tuned in more than a season ago, were like getting aggravated with her.
Yeah, I hope so, because I totally am. I'm with Blake. I'm gonna storm out of the room. I don't care how great that bonsai tree is at your clipping.
I love that bonsai tree, because that's basically like Crystal. She's got small aspirations, like. This is what she spends her day doing.
Honey, did you see that bonsai tree? It's the biggest fucking bonsai tree I've ever seen in my life.
How many bonsai trees have you ever seen in your life?
Three.
Not counting ones from Karate Kid.
Oh, I have never seen a bonsai tree in my life.
All right, I rest my case.
And now, where do you think Mark Jennings' head is at? Because after he has this...
I don't give a shit where Mark Jennings' head is at. Like, I just... This character, I'm so ready for him to be gone.
Oh, wow. I don't know. He's
oh,
kind
sorry.
Of...
I didn't mean to come in hot on that.
Yeah, just... really hot. I'm kind of, like, curious what he's thinking, especially after Fallon goes to his room, noticing that he's emotionally bereft. And I love... She's kind of her mom's... daughter. She gets a big old bottle of Dom Perignon and some glasses, and she's like, I'm gonna go figure out what the hell's wrong with this guy.
In some ways, she needed La Mirage to achieve her own independence. Like, this is Fallon's purgatory project, where she can be the queen of the damned. So she knows everything that's going on with Mark. Like, Mark is like this sort of like kept boy in her lair, you know. And yeah, she shows up with Dom Perignon, just casual, you know, like, here's a $200 bottle of champagne.
Well, I think that's more for her than him.
Oh, it's definitely for her. And she even says as much, because it's like this whole episode is sort of underpinned by this idea of a hangover from the Roaring Twenties party the night before.
Yeah.
You know, in some sense, she's just having some hair of the dog, both in the sense of the booze itself and also in this like extravagant champagne.
Also,
but Mark's not having a champagne.
The hair of the hairy chest of the dog, Mark Jennings, she walks in and he ain't wearing nothing but a towel. This guy was like a hunk or something, because they wasted no time getting him
stripped. They were all
down.
In on the Burt Reynolds Playboy spread with this guy.
Yeah, I think if you freeze framed at one point, you could see his like
dong da dong dong dong.
He was doing the shampoo challenge.
Let me see
decades
that.
Before. But yeah, you see what his motivations are, because Fallon questions his not masculinity, but his like sexuality or his prowess. And he wastes no time in grabbing her and planting another one of those mustache smooches on her.
Yeah, she goes for a mustache ride.
Mm-hmm.
Crystal, isn't it? I saw you talking on the terrace last night. Do you want to tell me about it?
That's none of your business. And please, take your champagne and leave. And please, do leave.
Temper, temper. It's not my fault if you didn't turn her on. Maybe you've lost your touch.
Who says? Still think I've lost it?
So I was wrong.
I don't think she was like, I mean, she wasn't like pulling away. She wasn't as grossed out as Kirby was by Adam, but she definitely was kissing back. So I think, you know, hey, she's a gal who likes attention from men, right?
I just feel like this is a mess because I don't really give a shit about Jeff and Fallon staying together, but like,
no, I also that's don't so want, done.
I don't want a storyline with Jeff and Kirby, and I don't want a storyline with Mark and Fallon.
So do you want to just stop doing this podcast and watching this show? Because that's like 75% of what's driving the narrative here.
Well, hopefully we'll get Steven and Claudia back soon.
Oh, there definitely was some Steven teases. I was like squealing some when steezes. I saw some steezes. So they've been kind of teasing us with Steven because he's been mentioned a lot by Fallon. And then there were some postcards from Hong Kong. And now we actually get some kind of, I thought it was just maybe like a body double, but I guess it apparently was really Jack Coleman because he's in the credits and the new Stephen Carrington.
See, you know, that's a real Easter egg. Like, you can watch the title credits as much as you want. You're not going to get all the info.
Yeah, they finally don't spoil.
They kind of bury Jack Coleman in the end credits, but yeah, I guess this is like his first appearance.
But you can't see his face. You really cannot see his face.
You basically get a silhouette of like some overmoosed hair.
Yeah, you see the hair. You see that he's probably like a foot taller than Al Corley laying in that bed on the oil rig.
Lying in that bed.
Yes. No, he's totally telling the truth, I think.
The whole Java Sea thing, it's the only reason you would know is because they call it that. And then they play that damn racist kung fu music again.
But yeah, apparently Steven is just toiling away on a oil rig, and that's where he's been. And he's got some friend who's reminding him that he's a rich Carrington and he shouldn't throw that all away.
Well, you have to, well, that's kind of a, I feel like there's something from a Dickens novel, I forget now, but there's something to be said for the character that points out to another character that they are owed an inheritance and have a family name, and how that friend is not really a true friend. I'm sure it comes back later, but there's obviously some breadcrumbs being dropped there, I think.
Yeah, I just didn't think that we were going to be having this much Steven this quickly in the third season. So,
well, they keep name dropping him like mm-hmm. the last few episodes. So they're trying to keep him on the audience's mind, even though unless you were here for season 1.5, you don't even know who this guy is or why do they keep talking about him?
Well, and
other
I
than
thought,
for him to be like a punching bag for Adam to like call out to, you know, Alexis that he's like the homosexual failure son.
Right. The wayward homosexual, mm-hmm. which is weird because I thought the whole thing with Al Corley leaving and them making him gay and then straight with Sammy Joe, the fact that they keep sort of dropping these or at least Adam Carrington keeps dropping these like homosexual references. It's like, okay, we're not totally flipping the switch on this character here.
Also, we're not flipping the switch on what his sexuality is. We've gone back and forth so many times. And
I haven't. I have maintained that he is bi. Bye, bye, bye.
Well, yeah. And you're not going to get much evidence from this particular episode. However,
hell, you can't even see his face.
Adam refers to him as a homosexual. Of course, that's because in the time, anybody doing anything that wasn't
mm-hmm.
P&V, man and woman, was just going to be classified as homosexual.
Oh, yeah. If you even looked at a dick, you were a gay.
Yeah. So I don't know. I'm not sure how much of this is cultural context versus what the actual character just, you know, is up to. But that's not going to be settled today. So,
well, yeah, it may not be settled ever because at the end of the episode, that oil rig explodes. So I guess he's dead. So bi, not bisexual. I mean, like bi, like you're dead now. we know you're not, because we know that Jack Coleman plays this character for many years. So I've been spoiled.
During Mark and Fallon's like weird reverse housekeeping role play sex thing that they're doing or not, I don't know. Mark refers to his taxes in 1776.
Okay, let's blame the IRS. They're auditing my tax return for 1776.
I think there's like a scene earlier where Kirby is talking to Fallon and makes a reference to 1776. And so like, I'm starting to wonder, are like Mark and Kirby, is this why we hate them so much? Because they're like time travelers from 1776. They're total outsiders. They don't belong here. And I knew there was something to it. And I think I finally figured it out.
They're from the past or they're stuck in the past?
They're, either way, they're not working. And I think that's why. Because they're from some other time period and they don't belong here. And they need to go back to wherever the hell they, you know, get in their DeLorean and go 8 miles per hour.
I think you just don't like the new people. Well, you know who doesn't like Kirby? That's her damn daddy. He is fucking, he practically bends her over his knee and paddles her bottom like Mark Jennings was threatening to do with one of his tennis instructees a few episodes ago, because he sees her.
That's not the kink I would go with him. I think he just likes to watch.
Oh, I don't think he likes to watch. It's like Fallon said.
Well, Kirby, maybe he likes to hate watch.
Kirby is a little girl in his eyes and a virgin, and the fact that he knows that she has this failed relationship on France, and now he sees her massaging Jeff Colby's shoulders inside the Carrington
Mansion.
I think
he spent a little too much time watching that happen, though.
It did seem like he probably was watching for at least like 5 minutes or something.
Which is about long enough to get off in the rose bushes.
But what was he supposed to do? Like, go in and break them up and not let them touch each other?
I mean, if he's as bitchy as we all think he is, he probably would have done that. So I think he likes to watch.
I don't think he would have been able to pull Kirby off of Jeff. My God. God, she is so hot and bothered for this man.
I think Kirby's a Jezebel.
Yeah.
She's been sent from another land to disrupt everybody's...
Or another time.
Yeah, or another time, for that matter. And like, she's like dressed like a kindergarten teacher.
Her clothes are terrible.
Going on like a randy but unsatisfactory happy hour at Ruby Tuesday. I don't know. There's something about Kirby and her look in this episode specifically that's just highly suspicious.
Well, yeah, it's kind of weird. I think maybe she is a slut on the DL, but she dresses kind of prim and proper to hide the fact
that's
that
because
she's...
I think she's a psycho, because she even says these like psycho babble lies about baby's first words.
Oh yeah, and she's lying to both Fallon and Jeff.
And then she's like, but then she uses that to seduce Jeff in the drawing room essentially, and then like she has like the nerve to say to her papa, do you think I'm a fallen woman? I mean, she's a Jezebel. She's a shiksa.
Well,
like,
we learned in this episode that she was basically a mistress. I thought maybe she was a prostitute, but I guess she was just a mistress. So she likes that role, I guess. I think she likes being the other woman. But now, do you think Jeff is really into her, or is this lead paint just obfuscating his true feelings?
No, I think like a true psycho, she's taking advantage of the fact that Jeff's got impaired judgment right now.
She doesn't know that he's been inhaling that crazy shade of teal.
Right, but I think she senses it because, she's a psychotic, and so she knows that she's got an entry point to take advantage of somebody in a moment of weakness.
I don't know.
Which I also get from Adam.
Oh, now talk about psychotic.
Adam and Jeff in Jeff's office. Ooh, that's also another homoerotic moment. Like, you can tell that Adam is sort of imposing a sort of like masculine gaze on him. But see, he knows that he's impaired because Adam's obviously the one who put the magic paint on the walls.
Oh, I didn't think that was as crazy as him coming out of that elevator at Colby Co. and grabbing Kirby immediately. And she was clearly recoiling the whole time. I mean, that was like a Weinstein moment.
Well, because
all the way through.
This is like how two signs aren't compatible. Two psychos aren't compatible. Like, there's only room for one psycho in a relationship. And like, Kirby and Adam are never going to work out on that level.
I think if we were to lock them in a mental ward together, he would definitely be put in the padded room, and she would at least be, you know, let out into the yard to play for an hour or two. Well, Adam can be as creepy as he wants with Kirby, but he can't be creepy in front of his mama because she fucking puts the smack down on him.
Just remember one thing, Adam. I know more about Colby Co. and about life and about everything than you do. And I can still teach you a few things.
Such as?
Such as manners, for one, as I taught your brother.
The wayward homosexual.
The always polite and sometimes misunderstood young man who was far too well-bred to ever be rude to his mother. I suggest that you use Stephen as your example whenever he finally decides to come home.
I mean, it turns out Blake gives better head than Alexis does.
God, you are obsessed with Blake and the congressman having some sort of sexual liaison.
They're doing Mile High Club stuff. But anyway, but Adam calls out Alexis and says something about...
Should we put your like gay dynasty fanfic on our Patreon? Patreon.com/nastypodcast?
No, because it's kind of half-baked. There's... Everything I've said is already more than what's on the screen.
Okay, so. We'll work on it.
No, what happens is Adam and Alexis getting this little tiff at that, you know, they've been doing this because they're locking horns.
Well, she has to keep constantly sort of asserting her power.
Right, but he says something about Blake calling her manipulative. And she says, ha, I invented that word. And this is ultimate Alexis. This is more of like Alexis's origin story. Like, of course she invented the word manipulative because that's what we've always known about this character. And it's punctuation.
No, I love the fact that this little twerp thinks that he can play in the same sandbox box as his mother and even father. And nah, it ain't happening. Go back to the paint store, bro.
Or Billings, Montana.
Ooh. Now it's time for us to choose our looks of the week. There wasn't, after last week's historical monumental extravaganza, this week was a little lackluster.
I think they're trolling us because we bitched so hard about all the costumes at the party.
Well, we bitched about it last week. However, this episode was made, you know, 38 years ago.
1776.
No, the only outfit that made me tingle was once Crystal got to Acapulco. She had this all-white look when she met with the Mexican lawyer with the worst haircut ever. He looked like a member of the Bee Gees or something. But it was...
So do Jeff and Adam.
That's true. Maybe they should all just get together and form a tribute band. But no, it was... she had like this really lacy and super... Super duper low cut blouse. I don't think we've ever seen this much cleave on Mrs. Carrington before.
Well, I know that would seem that way, but we've seen some off the shoulder looks with her before, but we do seem to call it out because it's not crystal like.
It's no. This, I'm not even talking about the shoulders. I'm talking about the boobies. And I think that Linda Evans probably put some bronzer on for this scene, too, because she's looking
in Acapulco.
Nice and tan.
I feel like that's what the top is about. Like, it's got that flouncy off-the-shoulder plunging neckline thing that, for some reason, the late 70s associated with Acapulco or Mexican...
Well, remember we had...
Like, more chips and salsa.
We had, I was going to say, remember Alexis wore that Mexican waitress outfit, which was kind of doing the same thing? Many episodes ago, but this is much more fashionable than that. And I love the belt. It's got like a big bronzy detail, and you know, she's paired it with a nice pair of high-waisted
mom,
of course, it's always pants. Gonna be yeah. mom pants with Crystal. But I don't know, I thought it was like a fun, easy breezy fun, I just checked into my hotel in Acapulco look, and I'm meeting with the divorce lawyer.
I mean, you could not wear that today.
I could not wear that today? How dare you? I have the body to pull that off. Kyler, what was your look of the week?
My look of the week is only because it's in contrast. What the hell is Alexis flitting around in her penthouse apartment in Mirabeau feathers and satin? You know, it's like so inappropriate with her son. Like, I don't even know if that's appropriate with a gardener around, but certainly not with her son around. Like, so what is that? Like, she's basically in her, like, in fancy underwear in front of her own flesh and blood. It's just bizarre.
Well, but there's like a robe. It's like a robe, right? So she's covering the goods up in front of her son.
She's covering to show, though, because like then like the cleavage is out. It's all lacy tits.
Well, and, it's definitely
and it is like it's sexy. The Mirabou Feathers, like, you know, CFM look. I don't know. There's something about it that I just feel like is inappropriate. And then I'm like, I'm reminded of like my friends when we were growing up. Like, you always knew that one kid whose parents like would hang around the house naked.
Like, wait, what?
I hope that doesn't happen anymore, but apparently that was like just like people would do that.
I don't know what was going on in your neighborhood. My friends, so I'm just
getting, yeah, I'm just getting like trauma vibes, like parents who are dressed inappropriately. Or
I thought you were gonna say everybody always had that one parent who shopped at Fredericks of Hollywood. I didn't realize you were gonna say naked. This is a huge step from naked. I mean, she's covered up. Can't see anything.
I mean, it's offset by the fact that she is like sort of like, you know, sauntering around with all those like flowing satin and feathers, and so that's like a nice thing. But
yeah, somebody.
But then when like you kind of like settle in and realize, wait a minute, like this is so inappropriate. Like the way that she is undressed.
Okay,
in front of her
that's
son.
A pot kettle black situation for sure. Because you, especially in our quarantine life, you will wear your robe for hours and hours and hours with
You're not my son.
Nothing underneath.
Do you think she's wearing nothing underneath though?
She's probably got no panties on. Do you wear panties underneath your robe?
Yeah. Well, no, I don't. I just wear boxer briefs, but you know.
Let's go do the shampoo challenge. Thank you so much for joining me for another edition of Dynasty As They Want to Be, Kyler.
Wax on, wax off.
And if you want to support the podcast financially, we have a Patreon. It's patreon.com/nastypodcast. That's NASTY podcast. But, you know, as always, we'll be dishing all of the dirt on Dynasty for free every week wherever fine podcasts are available. But if you want to keep up with us between the shows, you can follow us on social media. We're at Nasty Podcast on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, all the places. Just go to Nasty, NASTY podcast. And if you enjoyed this podcast, give us a review if you haven't already. We want 5 stars on iTunes, Stitcher, anywhere you can review a podcast. Next week, we'll be discussing the episode The Locket. It's been a while since we've had a jewelry-themed episode.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.